Welcome to Stonewall Spotlight, a monthly podcast by the Stonewall Democratic Club, focusing on the most salient issues in Democratic politics from the LGBTQIA and feminist lens. I'm Marcus Lovinggood, and I'm here with my co-host, Mackenzie Husband. How you doing, Mackenzie?
Hey, Marcus. I'm good. It's a new year, new blue. So much has happened since our last recording.
You're so right. So much has absolutely happened. I'm excited we are back. We're back from our season break and have lots of new and exciting interviews to share with you on the second season of Stonewall Spotlight, starting with your interview with LGBT pioneer Ivy Bottini.
Yes, absolutely. But first, I'd like to share a collection of voices from my travels overseas. In the time I've been involved with Stonewall Democratic Club here in LA, I've met so many wonderful people and participated in some meaningful activism. This club has broadened my mind and my friendships. Towards the end of last year, I had the opportunity to do some extensive traveling. And what better way to contribute to the club that has given me so much than to share the voices of the LGBT friends and people that I cross paths with? I hope this reminds us of our solidarity within the LGBT community, far and wide. And I want to start off by sharing a little portion of a conversation that I had with an Emiratis man from Dubai, which is in the Middle East. He said to me, "Being a gay man here is not so much about who you are, it's just something you do. Many people live dual lives, one public and one private." And that really struck me, the mindset of not being able to identify as gay, as if being gay was some sort of bad habit. The conversations I had with people were truly heartening. So let's hear from some of them now. I'm standing here with Dan Edwards, a very good friend of mine who lives in London, and he's going to tell us a little bit about his personal experiences of what it's like being a part of the gay community. Dan?
Thank you, Mac. So I've known Mac about 7 or 8 years now, and we met in London. I moved there from Australia many, many years ago, 13 or 14 years ago, and I was a closeted gay man at the time and didn't really do much in Australia, and actually moved to London to be a little bit more myself and to have an opportunity to be an openly gay man. And I was very comfortable doing that in London, and it took me a little while to find my way and a little while to, I guess, come out, but I was able to do it in a place called London. Mm-hmm. And couldn't really do that in Australia, so I was really, really glad that I kind of found my way and became myself. And that was 13 or 14 years ago, and I look back and wonder perhaps what my life would have been like if I never did that, and it would have probably been a very different scenario. So I'm incredibly fortunate and happy that I did what I did, and I've now moved on from London or in other parts of the world where it's never or not quite as open, and you always think back and look at it, and I was very grateful for the tolerance that London gives you, and the kind of people that you can meet in London of like-minded ways or whatever you call it, but like-minded people is amazing, and I'm very grateful to London and for what it has made me today, and that's me. Thank you.
Hi everyone, my name is Luke and I've been living in Paris for several years now. Being part of the LGBT community in Paris, it's in today's world especially, it's I would have to say that it's not that bad. With a whole new generation of LGBT coming up, they're reaping the benefits of what the older generation did, all the matches that they did, all the laws they tried to instigate and whatnot. They're actually reaping the benefits right now because, like, it's quite open to be LGBT. It's not an issue, really. Although there are some oppositions from extreme right right-wing parties where you have, sometimes they have rallies that they don't like the idea of the LGBT community adopting children or having children. So you've got that. It is, however, it is especially difficult as a black person to be LGBT in Paris because, or in France in general, for the simple reason, it's more of like a black social issue than an LGBT issue. But it doesn't help that black is not seen as so much as beauty. The standard, the idea of beauty in the LGBT community in Paris, it's like, I would say off the top of my head, maybe 5% black, right? The idea that people have of a black person, it's the polished idea, the movie, it's like the tough, muscular, handsome black man. But like, it's not every black man is like that. And so those people are like relegated to the opposite. And you can actually see that on the applications that are used, the Grindr, Bender, so on. By the way, Grindr is doing a great job trying to educate the people, the members who use this site, as to not to use this type of term, that I'm not interested in. I'm not interested in black or Chinese or Asian and stuff like that. Instead, they try to get people to say that what they want instead of not what they don't want. But it is something that is very, it pushes black people towards loneliness, especially black LGBT community, because like they're the minority within a minority, and that is completely insane.
My name is Ballerino, and as such, I've only experienced the best Dubai has to offer. Of course, one needs to be careful, one needs to be respectful, and one needs to be out of sight, out of mind, almost, so to speak. Not quite, but you can live a very happy, healthy, and exciting life in Dubai as a member of the LGBTQ community. And there is wonderful, fantastic, exciting places to visit, memories to make, and also people to meet from all spectrums of Dubai society. Be it your sheikhs or your sheikhs or your humble worker bees, and being very busy, a busy bee, but having a fantastic time. So please do come to Dubai, come and see for yourselves that it's actually not such a bad place to be as an LGBTQ person, and there are lots of opportunities. People are amazing, they are very respectful, and as such, the legislation also dictates that one should be respectful of anyone and everyone in society, which includes us, which is very exciting. Although on paper, you know, what happens behind closed doors remains unseen and should never be aired in public, so to speak. But if you are straight or gay, the same rule applies. So that is a very democratic way of looking at things. Wrapping it up very quickly, all the best. Hope to see you soon. From Dubai to Abu Dhabi, from Sharjah to Al Ras Al Khaimah, you are welcome. Come to Dubai, you won't regret it. This is Ballerino. Goodbye.
Hi, my name is Lily, and I am originally from Brazil. I think even though we may give out this idea to the rest of the world that we are a liberal and accepting country, unfortunately that could not be getting far from the truth. Being a member of the LGBT community has been a greater challenge. We have just experienced something very unique in our politics with the election of the new president. We've always been a very polarized country in terms of ideology, but it's the first time since our dictatorship that we've had such this agreement and an ideology and concepts of tolerance and what are the limits and what are the rights of the government. And I would like to talk about a little bit of what made this candidate so unique and so successful. Well, first of all, I gotta say that Brazil is a country heavily built on religion. Even though we do have in our constitution that state and the church are completely separate, that has never been true in reality. So what we have with this candidate is he was able to unite three pillars of the right-wing thought. And that would be the military, who had not been in power since the end of the 80s decade, after the end of the dictatorship. Also, the free market supporters, and also the evangelicals. And with that came hate speech. I think it would be fairly correct to say that much of his simple speech could be compared to what made Trump so attractive to the population. So Bolsonaro was able to unite these three very powerful groups. So even though they have different goals in mind and they have different objectives, the discourse really resonates with all of them. And his discourse was based on the preservation of the traditional family. That's an expression that, those conservative politics, they just love. The preservation of the traditional family. And then we ask ourselves, what is a traditional family? Well, for them, it's a heterosexual family. That obviously is a direct threat to the LGBT community. We do have the right of for same-sex marriage, but lately it's been in discussion in the Senate to abolish that. To take that back. And the newly elected president is one of the supporters. Well, I'm a gay woman, and I feel like I'm pretty much still in the closet in Brazil. I don't feel safe to express myself to everyone and to just, you know, like walk around holding hands with my girlfriend, because I think I could get some violent reactions from people.
Hi, my name is Mark, and I am from Scotland, from a tiny wee village called Dollar. It's about 45 minutes north of Edinburgh and about an hour away from Glasgow, which gives me the best of both worlds. Identifying as someone from the LGBTQIA sort of demographic, I have definitely been blessed with kind of understanding how different countries interact with the kind of people that we have. Scotland is a great country in itself. It's particularly coming from small villages like myself. You know, there's a lot of countryside, a lot of farm, and people think that associated with that is a lot of stigma. I think times are changing. So as you go to the bigger cities like Glasgow and Edinburgh, there is very much a prominent scene here. Edinburgh and Glasgow have very different scenes. I would say Glasgow is probably more vibrant and more underground, and I would say that Edinburgh is probably more cosmopolitan and more kind of built for tourists, if you will. So yeah, Scotland's pioneering itself in a lot of ways, especially in LGBTQIA kind of rights. So we passed gay marriage way back in 2012, I think it was, and that was before England did it. And we have just passed a law that all educational institutes required mandatory learning for LGBT to all of their students. You can also, as a gay man, you can get PrEP. People don't know this, but you can get PrEP for free on public healthcare. So the government pays for you to get PrEP, which is reducing numbers of HIV. So it's just great. So you don't have to do anything. You can just walk into any kind of clinic and they will just prescribe it for you right there and then. In terms of like the people, you know, it's one of those places that you can actually just go on your own. Because Scottish people have a very warm and welcoming curiosity, if you will. And because the cities are quite big, but the number of LGBT people that are in these places, you see a new face come around, you will be instantly kind of gravitating towards this new person. Who are you? Why are you here? You know, let's have a chat. Let's see where you are. I've gone out on my own many times and I've always made new friends when I'm out.
My name is Craig and I live in London. So being a gay man in London is probably one of the most wonderful things, because for me, I think it feels like one of the global capitals, if not the global capital, for the LGBTQ plus community. You can be anything. You can dress however you like, you can call yourself whatever you like, and get on the tube and no one bats an eyelid, and I think it's wonderful. I almost wonder if so I have a very interesting kind of background. I've grown up on a small island. I grew up in the Channel Islands, a kind of British group of islands, and I grew up on an island called Jersey. I went to an all-boys Catholic school, so I had quite a strict upbringing in that sense, so I know what it's like to not have that acceptance. So what I found quite strange in London, and it's not necessarily specific to London, but it exists there, is that you can find your place in the gay community, but it can feel quite cliquey. Mm-hmm. You are very quickly and clearly defined and put in a box. You are part of this community in this way, and when you step outside of that, that's when things get a little bit interesting. You know sometimes I can feel, you know, I'm too tall, maybe I'm not tall enough, I'm, you know, too fat, you know, or I'm too thin, or I'm muscular or not muscular enough, and then that's when it starts to get quite hard, and when the irony of being a gay person and being part of in some countries a marginalized community, is that actually I have struggled in some ways to find that acceptance, and I've tried really hard to make myself a person that would be accepted and recognized by others. The incessant going to the gym, worrying about what I eat, how I look, doesn't come from the kind of a very trivial narcissism. It's just from a much deeper wanting someone to love me and accept me. So that is the part of being gay in London I have found most difficult, because you will get that anywhere to a certain extent, but because London is, you know, a stage for the world, it is where the greatest and the best and the most ambitious will be. So all of this is heightened times 10 times 100 times 1,000, and Mac, you probably know about some of that being in LA, right? So it's wonderful, I love it, but it's also hard and it's difficult at the same time. And the journey that I've been on most recently in terms of discovering myself, I think will also allow me to rediscover London as well. So I love it. I would change parts of it. I wouldn't change other parts of it. Hear, hear.
My name is Dan.
My name is Luke.
My name is Ballerino.
My name is Lily.
My name is Mark.
My name is Craig.
And we are Stonewall.
Stonewall Democratic Club is a countywide LGBTQ organization looking for members and volunteers. Are you wondering how you can get involved and make a difference in the resistance? Join the Stonewall Democratic Club today by visiting stonewalldems.org. We want you.
Is an iconic women's rights and LGBT activist. She spent her first 40 years living as a straight woman, but typical suburban life was not in her destiny. When Ivy turned a corner and became an activist, there was no stopping her. Her activism really ignited in 1966 when she co-founded the New York City chapter of the National Organization for Women. She was elected as its president and came out of the closet a year later. She brought issues to the table like, is lesbianism a feminist issue? And feminist consciousness raising. In 1970, she famously went on to lead a demonstration at the Statue of Liberty, where she and several other women draped an enormous banner over the edge of the statue, which read, "Women of the World Unite!" After moving to Los Angeles, she then went on to co-found the Coalition for Human Rights, which was a major contributor in successfully blocking the 1978 California Proposition 6, or Briggs Initiative, that sought to ban gay and lesbians from working in California's public schools. After that, it was cemented. Ivy would work with anyone to achieve a common goal for LGBT rights. She created and hosted the first lesbian and gay radio show on a mainstream network. She also co-founded the LA Lesbian Gay Police Advisory Board, AIDS Network LA, AIDS Project LA, and a nonprofit organization for gay and lesbian elder housing. It seems like if there was a worthy cause, Ivy was a part of it. Her public service is truly inspirational. I'm sitting down today with the charismatic activist and feminist Ivy Bettini, a living legend at 92 years young. How are you today, Ivy?
Waiting for 93. I'm fine.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we are so pleased for this opportunity to talk with you before you move back to the East Coast. I understand you're moving to Florida to live with your daughter.
Yes, I am, and her wife.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we wish you a fair bon voyage, and we will miss you for sure. And we actually just saw each other last week at the West Hollywood Library.
Yes.
Because you have a new book coming out, and it's about you. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about it?
Well, it's a biography. Mm-hmm. I worked with a biographer by the name of Judith Brandsburg.
Yeah.
Yes. And it took us, I guess, for about 4 years from the moment the light went on. And that alone was an adventure. And the book published around a month ago, and it's getting really good reviews. It's called The Liberation of Ivy Bettini, Love and Activism.
Excellent. Well, our readers can find that on Amazon, which I highly recommend because it was a good read, for
you,
sure.
You were at the read the other night.
I was, yes, yes.
At City Hall.
Yes, you were quite funny.
I was a comedian before the book started. Mm-hmm. I was an activist comedian, and I was traveling for a while.
Well, I could definitely tell that the audience was definitely enjoying it.
We all had a great time.
As did myself. So we're interested in reviewing with you some of your amazing activism that you've led over the years. So let's dive right in, shall we?
Yes, please do.
So could you briefly tell us about your coming out story?
Well, it was a lifelong search for who I really was. When I started in kindergarten, I immediately fell in love with a gym teacher. And she could whistle through her teeth. It was just, oh man, was I crazy about her.
And you were taken.
Yes, I really was. And then I fell in love with my third grade teacher. And, you know, high school, we had two different gym teachers. And then in college, I also would have very strong feelings for an occasional friend female. Mm-hmm. I thought I was the only one that felt that way. So I didn't speak about it to anybody. But I knew that it was not common, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm.
And this is back in the 50s and 60s, you'd say?
I was born in 1926. Mm-hmm. And so, what, was I five or six? I think I was six when I started kindergarten. So that was, what, 1932?
Wow.
And then, of course, I graduated from art school and I fell in love with a lovely young woman in my class by the name of Judith Klink. Mm-hmm. She never knew it, of course. Nobody knew it except me.
Right.
And, that was the story that was about to be my life. Mm-hmm. And it was getting really painful to feel this way. And no, you can't say anything to anybody.
Mm-hmm. And then your involvement in the National Organization for Women seemed to be a turning
for women.
For women, that's
for
right.
women.
It seemed to be a turning point for you in the organization.
Yes.
What was your experience with NOW that prompted you to found the chapter?
I lived in Levittown at the time with my husband and my two daughters. And I was struggling because, you know, I'm a mom, I've got two kids and a husband that is a really nice guy. But yet I have this yearning. And then I was working for Newsday, daily newspaper, mm-hmm. at the time. And there was a reporter that had joined the paper about 5 years before what I'm going to tell you. And I loved her so much. And she was straight. Everybody's straight. They're all straight.
Of course. But not really.
And we were supposed to have lunch. And so she called me. I was in the art department. And she called me and she said, I can't have lunch. I have to go into New York and interview some broad. That's what we used to say. Mm-hmm. That word was very popular. And so I was disappointed. And she said, but let's have dinner when I get back. Okay. She goes, comes back. And my phone rings in the art department. And I pick it up. It's Dolores. And I said, oh, you're back. She said, yes, get in here. And hangs up. And it sounded like urgent, like maybe she cut her arm off or something. And so I go run. I literally ran down the hall into the sitting room. And in front, I got in front of her desk and she was typing madly. And I said, I'm here. And she didn't answer me. I said, what? What did you want? And she didn't even look up. She stops typing with one hand and picks up a piece of paper and is still typing with the other hand and thrusts it at me without even looking at me and says, sign this. I said, what is that? She said, just sign it. So I would have signed anything. My firstborn, the house, you know. So I signed it and I went back into the city room, into the art department. And she was another couple of hours. And finally she came, she called me on the phone. And she said, okay, let's go to dinner. So we went to our local place, which was on the same street, but up about a mile. And it was a bar restaurant. And we're sitting at the bar. And finally I said to her, what did I sign? She said, with great vigor, she said, you just joined the women's movement, the National Organization for Women.
And you didn't even know it.
And I had no clue. You're making history and I don't even know I'm doing it.
It's too funny.
So she and I went on to found the first chapter of NOW, National NOW in the United States, and the chapter was in New York City. And we founded it in less than a month from the story, mm-hmm. and it really started to grow rather rapidly.
And it was also about this time when you changed your life to live with a woman. How did that experience inform your activism?
Not really. I have found over my three partners that it's not as easy as living with a man as living with a woman. It's very complicated living, yes. for me. Mm-hmm. Women are complicated and very worthwhile, though, I have to admit. Very, very worthwhile. And
well, I know you brought questions to the table, like, is lesbianism a feminist issue and feminist consciousness raising? Is that right?
Yes, I created feminist, not consciousness raising, but feminist consciousness raising.
Okay.
And that was in 1968. What happened was, the name of the organization is National Organization for Women. which men joined. And right from the beginning, within the first month, we probably had about a half a dozen men join. And when I decided that we needed feminist consciousness raising that really centered on how women are controlled, I started doing feminist consciousness raising no more than 20 people and no crosstalk, which is a general rule. And you had to stay on topic. And I had 8 titles, each 8 weeks. Each week had a different title. Mm-hmm. And the first one was, Do Women Like Other Women?
Good question.
Yes, and it was fascinating. listening to women who actually, in their individual conversation, they could ask me questions, but I didn't really answer them. I just kept it going, and I'd say, what do you think? Mm-hmm. It was very interesting as you saw lights go on, like light bulbs above somebody's head. And then another topic was rape, the tool of the oppressor. And then I had, the last one I did was, Is Lesbianism a Feminist Issue? Because by this time, I had observed those couple of years before I put CR together, I had observed that there were other lesbians in the New York Now chapter. And they were deep, deep, deep in the closet. And I knew who several of the couples were. And I remember one couple always arrived at a meeting separately and with maybe 5 or 6 minutes in between each entrance. So, and then they would sit on the opposite side of the room where the chairs were. And I know that for a fact because my then partner, we would go over to their apartment, have dinner, and we'd be dancing with, maybe another couple came along. And mm-hmm. Anyway, that bothered me greatly. And so I decided to have a panel. And there were 14 women on the panel. And only 2 that I knew of were lesbians. And that was Barbara and her partner. And that was because she was very out after having lost her first partner. And it made a great impact on her. And so she had another partner. And other than that, everybody else acted as if they were heterosexual, which proved over the years proved to be not totally correct. Mm-hmm. And I was moderator. I wasn't really out yet. I did Kate Millett when she wrote her book Sexual Politics. The Times book reviews just slaughtered her, saying she's bisexual, and I mean they were using her sexuality to kill the book.
Wow!
Thank God it didn't work. But I put a big reporters come. Press conference.
Yep.
I put it was a huge press conference. And there were people from National Now there, and Steinem was there, and I can't remember more than that, but it was very big. And everybody that was at that press conference was not a lesbian. As a matter of fact, there was a minority of us there, but the newspaper honestly thought everybody who, well, why would you dare say anything about that subject if you're not one of them? And that was how people thought back there.
So was this really the momentum of the lesbian purge that came from now and ultimately led to you moving to the West Coast? Is that right?
Yes. I was very, very surprised that people on a national board had actually planned what to do at the election to get rid of me. Mm-hmm. And normally at an election, we had maybe 40 people. We may not have been numbers big, but we were fun and very active. You know, you don't need an army to create a win. Mm-hmm. So when I walked in, I was running for renewal of my presidency. And when I walked in, I thought, there's a lot of people here. I mean, it looked like a couple of hundred, easy.
Wow.
And when I was looking it over, I knew hardly anyone. I didn't see maybe a half a dozen faces I knew. And so the voting went, and I lost by seven. Well, it depends who you're talking to, either four or seven votes. I don't know. And I was really, I was shaken, because one of the things I said before, just before the vote, the day before, Barbara Love, that's her name, Barbara Love, and Sidney Abbott was on the panel. They were the only two I knew. And I got a call from Barbara, and she said, this is before the vote, she said, Ivy, there's a plot to get rid of you. I've got 30 lesbians ready to sign up to join, because they could join up until the vote. And they're ready to join and have your back, because they're out to get you. And I said, stupidly, I said, no, that's not fair. I trust the membership. Mm-hmm. Oh boy. And but thank you anyway. And so then I lost. And I really was stunned. The one thing it did was to sear my brain with how important an issue lesbians were.
Sure.
And the power that lesbians had if they showed up. Mm-hmm. So it was not a good thing that happened to me, but I realized that we had an issue that we could confront with. And so yes, about a month later, my then partner and I took off for California. And my daughter, Lisa, went with me, and Helen's daughter, Valerie, went. And the four of us drove across country. I thought I would never get out of Texas. Oh, God.
Well, luckily for all of us, you did get out of Texas.
Yes,
and
I did.
You found your way to Los Angeles.
Yes.
And as I was reading your book, that's when I learned more about your time as president of the Stonewall Democratic Club. Can you tell me about your experience with Stonewall in the late 70s, why you joined, the people you met, and how you came to be its president for a time?
Well, I'm not sure I meant to join. I'm not sure anybody really meant to join. It just kind of happened. Morris Kite, do you know that name?
I'm not familiar with it, no.
Yes?
No.
Anyway, Morris Kite was this older gay man who was kind of the... it's hard to explain, but he was very revered in the gay man's world. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how I got involved, except suddenly... It was before Stonewall was being created without people even knowing it yet. And then it was getting near an election time where, yes, Jimmy Carter.
Yes, Jimmy Carter.
And our governor, Jerry Brown, and a third candidate, they eventually were vying for the nomination for presidency to be chosen as a Democratic standard bearer. Suddenly, mm-hmm. it was Stonewall. And Morris was president, I think, first. And then very soon after that, I became president. We went to the convention. By this time, we're organized well enough to go to the convention where they're going to be trying to figure out who's going to be the standard bearer and run. And we choose to sit up in the balcony. We were in Sacramento. And so we choose to sit up in the balcony. Everybody's down on the floor, and it's all, you know, broken with... you know, from this city and that city and the signs and the yelling and the blah, 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 blah. And so Ken Schnur, he was president. Ken and I kind of go off to talk about our strategy. You know how it works, where you pledge yourself to one candidate, mm-hmm. and you pledge blah, blah, blah. Different place, Californians, Stonewall included, is from Fresno, and then there's somebody from some, you know, a group someplace else. We got them all together, all the people who had been elected to come and do this. We convinced them to not vote for any candidate until the third vote. And mm-hmm. conventions don't like to go to three votes.
No.
That makes them very nervous. So we did the first vote. We're in the balcony and we're looking down. The first vote, they can't pick anybody. And a few people glanced because we finally, you know, said we picked Jerry Brown. And we made them go to a third vote. And when we voted, everybody turned even before we told them what we were going to do. That was really the beginning of Stonewall's power, mm-hmm. and they knew it, and they didn't have a clue before that. They thought we were some, you know, there's a bunch of gay people, and they were nice, but they didn't realize the power that we had.
Yeah.
It wasn't just us, it was our allies. So that was a big turning point.
Wow.
For Stonewall.
That's excellent that you were there, and thank you for sharing a little piece of our club's history,
yeah.
with us.
Yeah, and Ken Schnur went on to die of AIDS. He
yes.
was
one of the first
three in L.A. Yeah,
yeah,
in California.
Well, your bio shows that you went on to found and participate in a number of other organizations over the years. And I'm curious to what motivated you to take on the leadership roles in all those ventures.
Well, I didn't think of it as the leadership role. I honestly didn't. Even as a kid, if I saw an open door, I would walk through it to see what was on the other side. I'm still very inquisitive when I suspect there's an issue under some discussion that really hasn't been birthed mm-hmm. yet. For some reason, I seem to be able to identify issues that it's going to come down on us before it arrives. My family was very, we were a troubled family. And so I guess I learned to sense something that was out there that I had to understand, or but I seem to understand there's something going on that I have to figure out ahead before it arrives. I think that's why it carried over. I believed that HIV and AIDS was bodily fluids, the cause, way before they started talking about bodily fluids. My friend who died, I got in touch with his doctor, and he died within a week. I mean, he was up and out, and all of a sudden he's driving home from his business, and he collapses, and a week later he's dead. And that didn't make a lot of sense to me. It just sounded weird. And for some reason, I called the CDC. I don't know why. I never thought of the CDC in my life. But before he died, when his mother called me and said, you know, I don't know what they're doing to my son, but he's full of black and blue marks. And that was Kaposi's. And I picked up the phone and called the CDC. I don't know why, but I did. And then as the weeks and months started to go by, I thought, because everybody's going, how is it? How do you catch it? How do you catch it? And it didn't make sense that any other way, it had to be fluids. So I asked Ken's doctor if he would be on a town hall with me, really getting the word out, you know, because I believed it was bodily fluids. And he said, I do too. I will do it. So he came, and we were in Fiesta Hall, and it was so packed. There wasn't an inch on the floor that there wasn't, you know, bodies meeting the wood. And on the stage, we were surrounded with people sitting on the stage, and they were all guys, except for myself and my then partner. We put the warning out. It was bodily fluids. And there were, Morris Kite was very, very upset that I did that. He said, don't pay any attention to that, because they're just trying to control your sexuality. Talking to the gay men. Because, you know, women weren't even on the scale in the discussion about that. So that really got me deeply involved in that issue.
Right.
I mean, and there we are, and it's...
You went on to found...
50 years later.
Yeah, you went on to found the AIDS Network LA, the AIDS Project LA, and you've just...
I'm one, not the...
Co-founder, that's right.
AIDS Project LA. Mm-hmm. I actually was a founder with a bunch of people. You know, it wasn't all me.
Well, you've given so much of your time and leadership to our community, and we sincerely thank you. And...
Well, it was actually, I loved being in Stonewall. I really did. They actually voted that I could have a second term. So I had 4 years of the presidency. I guess I cut my teeth on politicians and politics while I was in Stonewall. Because I really didn't know that much, but I did know organizing. Mm-hmm. But I love Stonewall. They really have their own identity. They're not just Democrats.
Mm-hmm. I hear you.
They're just not. They're people who have lived through really hard times and hard psychological pressures, and it's not just a Democratic club. It's a survival club. And they have to be on guard all the time, because there was an incident last night. Larry Block, who has a gay and lesbian store, he got horrible phone calls last night, and they kept coming and kept going and saying, get out of here, faggot. Why are you in West Hollywood, faggot? I mean, it was horrible.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
To think it's here even in West Hollywood.
Yeah. But it's happening. You know, we're not out of the woods. And I wish they were more activist in the street, feet on the street.
Well, thank you for sharing those words. I hear you. Now we're going to fast forward a little bit to recent years, especially since the 2016 elections. We've seen a resurgence in activity for women's rights specifically, such as the women's marches, the Me Too movement, the 2018 midterm election results. What are your hopes for the next wave of the feminist activists?
That the women keep coming, that they keep coming. My dream is that we women take over Washington.
Yes, that's my dream too.
Yeah.
I like that dream.
Because it would be a whole new way of, I'm going to use the word ruling, but I don't really mean it in that full sense. Mm-hmm. Women think differently. You know, we don't think war. We think of how do we solve this. I've lived through 3 wars, several skirmishes, 3 assassinations or 4, at least 3. Mm-hmm. I've lived through and experienced those, and it's all for the same reason. Men think with power. Women think with good sense. There really is a difference.
Well, now we've seen at least 4 women candidates already declare their run for the President of the United States.
Yes. Harris did today.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, did you even think that was possible decades ago? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't think I ever got actually to the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Well, I bet back then it might have been hard to realize that there could be a potential female president in our future. You know, that's come a long way.
Yeah, I couldn't quite get to the presidency. But the fact that and then Shirley Chisholm ran.
Right.
And that was so, it was very inspiring when Chisholm ran, to think that a woman actually did that. So there was the hope that, see, somebody's done it now. Right. Somebody else can try it.
We did a whole piece about Shirley Chisholm on our podcast a few months back.
I saw a documentary the other night on her. I'm not sure what station, probably CNN or MS.
Sure, sure.
It was excellent. Well, yeah, I'm very, very excited about all the women. I sat here when midterm votes were going on. Mm-hmm. And I kept going, all right, one more. Come on, one more. Okay, now, another one. All right, one more. It was so exciting.
It really was.
And I went to the city council at some point because I figured if some of the power brokers in West Hollywood, women, could step forward and say, me too. Mm-hmm. I was the only one that would step forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any advice for young women and LGBT activists today?
Believe your gut. If you get the feeling that something is coming at us, believe what you believe and go check it out. And if you find there is something there, get to work on it right away. What happened when the Briggs, the Prop 6 proposition, I started organizing the state of, well, at least Southern California, 2 years before it really hit before people knew that Briggs was going to do this.
Mm-hmm. You had a sense of it.
I just knew it was going to happen. You know, Anita Bryant was in Florida causing trouble, and I just knew the next place would be here. So by the time a half year had, I mean 2 years had gone, and by that time I had organized a lot of the towns, you know, north of here and south. I went all the way down from San Diego all the way up to Santa Barbara and beyond, mm-hmm. halfway up the state. We were ready for him. We were ready. We weren't going to be taken by surprise, and he would have. So you just, if you believe something, do it. If you think something's going to happen, work to organize. Don't care if somebody said, what are you, out of your mind? That's not going to happen, because it probably is if you have a strong feeling about it. Anyway, that's what I believe. Get out, get out of the bars and into the street.
Wise words. Thank you, Ivy. Well, it's been a pleasure sitting down with you today. And
thank you. I'm sorry I was so stuttery
today.
Oh,
no, you're fine. You're fine. Thank you for making a difference in my life and that of so many others like me. We greatly appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Well, off the cuff.
Yes.
The one thing that I didn't say or talk, being a really serious, a committed activist, mm-hmm. that you really are involved, not maybe just one organization, but you get something going, then you move, you know, now it's healthy, and you go to the next issue, now it's healthy, and then you go to the next issue. If you're that kind of activist, it's very hard on relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware now that over the years, the three live-in relationships I had, the movement was more important than the relationships. And it wasn't that the reason was that I didn't care about them. I did.
Right.
But I wouldn't let my relationship interfere with the... The movement.
The movement had to come first for yeah. you. There's a lot of sacrifices, I'm sure.
Yeah. Made. And I was talking to a gay man yesterday. And I had said, I talked about that mm-hmm. at the book signing
yes.
the other night. And you know, he said, what you said was so true. Now that explains a lot about my life. When the movement comes first, that's pretty much 90% of your energy.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was it.
Well, thank you for sharing your energy, your time, and your life to the LGBT and women's issues. We greatly
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you. I am Ivy Bottini, and I am Stonewall.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Stonewall Spotlight. I'm your host, Marcus Lovingood.
And I'm Mackenzie Huffman, your co-host.
We'll see you next time on Stonewall Spotlight.